Hi, and welcome to Mental Health Ireland's podcast, promoting mental health, well-being and recovery with our guests and your listeners. I'm Carmen from Mental Health Ireland, and I'm joined today by two authors in their own right and strong voices for mental health and recovery, clinical psychologist Dr. Tony Bates and Senator Lynn Rowan. In this episode, we'll be looking at what we learnt about ourselves this year and how we can move forward after the challenges of 2020 and beyond. So, Tony, Lynn, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, Tony, you're joining us via Zoom today. Where in the world are you?
I'm about 13 miles north of Sligo. I'm out on a landmass, Strigia Point. It's like the sea on three sides of me here, sea at the end of the garden. And I live in a very beautiful place. We kind of made a decision to downsize and bought an old bungalow run down on a field. And just I've been doing it up for the last 8 years. It's gorgeous. I'm very lucky.
Wow. So worlds apart from where we are in Dublin today. Myself and Lynn.
I'm heading to Dublin today. I'm as soon as this is done, I've got to head up there, but I don't go there very often. And I go there as little as I can get away with it.
Mm. When you're living in heaven, why escape? No need to escape.
Yeah. And I have animals here and I look after them. And, you know, I feel very rooted. I've never felt I belonged as much as I do in this small community. Mm. A beautiful village nearby, and you know, I know people and they know me, and I just feel very at home, and I don't think I've ever had that in my life as much anyway until now.
That sense of belonging. So Lynn, in Dublin, back in Dublin, how have the last few months been for you?
They've been a mixed bag, really. I mean, if we kind of, you know, when we consider the last few months, I think we've kind of split our lives into two things, which is before March and after March. But it's been okay. I think for me, like listening to Tony there talk about the sense of belonging and the sense of home, even though obviously there's so much tragedy happening in the world and obviously there's a health crisis, but this is possibly the first time that I've also felt a sense of belonging and a sense of home in the home that I've actually always been in for 30 years. So for me, being forced to have to work from home, to stay still for a moment, I'm still in the same house I grew up in. And it was the first time in a long, long time that I was actually sitting out my back garden in a sense of stillness and a sense of feeling okay. And I suppose the last few months has shown to me that the thing that I've been striving for or was absent, which was safety and security, that I must have reached that place if I could be so calm and so comfortable sitting in the house and in the environment and the community that I was once probably feeling really chaotic in. So a sense of calm definitely has been the last few months, but also still working away and writing, and I write an awful lot, and it's been great to be able to focus a lot on my writing over the last few months, because I didn't realize the amount of time I'm in motion, in traveling to meetings, from meetings, driving to town, driving to different counties to give talks, and all the amount of hours that build up in your day. So like only last week I was like saying to my team in work, I was like, I feel like I'm not doing enough, like I'm not being very effective. But actually all that's really happened is all those times that I used to be in the car traveling places are now time that like I have to think about how I fill them, you know. So I've tried not to fill them with more work, and I've tried to fill them with writing and with meditation and with running and things like that, because I could have felt very quickly into kind of just piling more and more work on, and I haven't. So yeah, the last few months have been a time of, I suppose, realization of where I am and who I am as a 36 year old woman.
Okay, Tony, so you've been in your haven for the last few months. Is there anything that you've missed this year?
Well, of course. I mean, I think all of us are affected by what's happening in some way. And certainly for me, not being able to see my grandchildren, I have four of them, and that's been a great loss. And, you know, I'm beginning to feel it now. Thankfully, when I go to Dublin, we're going to meet in a park and have some kind of a meeting. But I, you know, it's August, since early August, since I've seen the two boys I'm seeing tomorrow. And so that's something I've missed. I haven't missed other things, but then again, I'm at a stage in my life where I've retired, and I don't, you know, that releases you from all kinds of concerns that, say, Lynn would have at 36. It's a different stage of life, you know. It's I've far less to worry about, and that's that makes, you know, living here much simpler. My life has never been as simple. But I'm doing things as well. I keep in touch and all that. It's not like I've disappeared. And for me, the success has been being able to, when you're alone particularly, being able to have a rhythm in your day that sort of sustains you, carries you through the day. So there's a sort of there are things I do when I get up, and they're simple things, but they're very important. I've learned that. To carry myself through and to go to bed earlier and sleep more and things like that. And I took up learning piano, and I just got a keyboard last year, thankfully. So I've been working really hard on that. And I'm a very late beginner, but I'm just enjoying it immensely. So there's lots of, I vary things. I think variety is important. We need things that exercise, we need time for reflection, we need to try something new we haven't done. I think those are the things that keep us going.
Okay, so Lynn, Tony learned how to play the keyboard. I think I can just about manage chopsticks. What did you learn about yourself this year? Like I learned that I struggle probably to let go of control with all the changes around me. That was a massive learning curve for me. What did you learn about yourself?
That all the work that I've put into myself for all these years, for these 20 years, I've learned had a payoff. I feel somewhat healed, and I'm not searching anymore. And I think for years I've spent trying to do good, trying to be good, trying to search for the good, without necessarily feeling the feedback of my actions, because inside I was sad or scared. So what I've learned has been, I suppose, it's like, you know, sort of an awakening to the fact that everything that I've put in, even though it's been a long road, has had an impact. So I'm feeling what healing actually is.
Wow. And yeah. Do you think that having that bit of extra time where you're not stuck in traffic, getting stressed out, having that time to reflect has helped with this?
Yeah, completely. You know, when I was sitting at home, especially during those sunny days out the back garden, I was volunteering on a helpline for safety net services, directing people that are in the migrant community and the homeless community, like kind of triaging them and getting them in for testing and getting them into isolation. And I was sitting at home working away doing that, and I remember thinking, just thinking how far away from feeling what they're feeling. I can still empathize with what they're feeling, but everyone that I used to work for and work with, I was always only ever a step ahead of them in my journey, you know. So I was so close to the chaos even in myself while I was trying to help, where I could feel the distance, and not in a way that I felt disassociated from people that I'm helping, but in a way that I no longer felt triggered by the work that I was doing, you know. And like throughout that time, the amount of women actually we had to ring Saoirse Refuge and stuff for during that time, who became homeless because of COVID and domestic abuse and stuff. And I remember just realizing just where my life could have been in terms of the lives that people experience and where my life is now. And even though I've always been on that trajectory, I've never been able to acknowledge that I feel any different than I did when I was in chaos. And, you know, so for me, having to be still and not be rushing from one meeting to the next and one subject to the next, and being able to sit still and really just acknowledge where I've come from and where I'm going. I think I always knew it intellectually, and I was always able to give the narrative of it, but that didn't necessarily mean that inside I was moving with the, like, I could give a narrative about what I think I should do and be and where I should go, and, you know, that I'm in therapy or I'm in counselling or I work in the homeless sector and this is what they need. So, but then there was something disassociated within me, you know, so I can recognise what needs to happen, but I didn't necessarily feel good within that. So for me, the slowing down has allowed me realise that I'm actually good and I'm okay and I'm safe. And I think that's probably been the biggest part of, I suppose, the last 10 months or so.
Yeah, and it's also about having the time to celebrate and to recognise how far we've come and the work that we've done. Because I think when it's all go, 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 it's like, right, what can I do next? Yeah, what can I do next?
I caught myself talking to boards out the back garden, and I was like, oh my God.
Like Snow White.
Or going, look at that little dog. I've never spoke like that in my life. You know, like this softness, you know, this kind of baby voice almost coming out, and I'm like, what am I becoming? Stop talking to the birds out your back garden. I've always had a much tougher exterior than that, you know what I mean? I'm starting to see meaning in things that I would have never seen before. Like a robin, sitting there looking at the robin at my back. Oh my God, there's a robin out my back. Where before I would have been like, shut up, but no significance just because there's a robin out your back. Where now I want to see the good in everything, because I feel good. So I can then see the good, and it's reflected back to me in everything, you know, and this kind of cynical kind of way of seeing things is or the harsher way of seeing things is kind of started to dissipate.
Tony, what about yourself? Are you talking to the birds? Or as a nation, like Lynn said, that time to reflect and slow down, is that giving us more of a chance as a nation and as people to connect to ourselves and to, you know, to those around us?
It's lovely hearing what Lynn just said, and it's a remarkable journey you're describing, Lynn. And it brought to mind the opening of Mary Oliver's poem, Wild Geese, which I'm sure you know, but it just, you were saying about being good, and what she says is, you do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And it kind of says what you're saying. I think for me, I was very surprised at how vulnerable I felt in the early months, particularly. I mean, I was very active and I liked being here, but I felt just immensely vulnerable. And I couldn't write. I had planned to write. I'd planned, you know, and I just couldn't write in that. Now I've picked it up, you know, but there was certainly 6 months where I just couldn't. And I think that it was a time, what Lynn is saying is so true, for all of us to kind of go into our own hearts and get to know ourselves in a deeper way. And I think that has been the invitation in this very difficult, strange time we've lived through. We're thrown back in ourselves, but there's also an opportunity in that to get to know ourselves more, to get to know our own truth. What is it that is true for me? I think COVID revealed us to ourselves in all kinds of ways, and lots of ways we probably weren't proud of, because we thought we'd be better, we'd get fitter, we'd lose, or whatever, you know. But I think there is the sense that when you're alone, you do have a chance to get to know your own truth. And when you then speak from that place, it's with a different voice, and it's, you know, it is a more tender voice, you know, as Lynn was saying. And I think that is something I sincerely hope that we can be just a little kinder, perhaps, to each other as a result of what we've been through. But again, human nature, who knows?
Is there any group in our society that has surprised us or surprised you in particular?
Lynn
or Tony, you know, any group that surprised you, any age group, any demographic,
No, I have to say they didn't. Like, I mean, and over time, like, you've kind of seen different groups be targeted for you're not doing enough, or they're doing great and they're not, and this back and forth. And I just don't think that any of that is actually reflective of how people were. I don't think any demographic can be generalized as behaving in some particular way or doing things better or not doing things well enough and stuff. And for me, I just, because I've continued to kind of support community services throughout this time, I think they just continue to astonish me with how quick that they've adapted and taken their services online. And, you know, do you know what? And I'm so proud of people. I'm the chair of the Canals Drugs Task Force, and to watch people who, because some people have died that were in recovery, some people relapsed, some people took their lives, and that doesn't really, like, they might not have died of COVID, but it's COVID related, and some of those deaths are going to be lost a little bit. Like, there was people waiting to go into the likes of Keltai that when that service closed because it was opened as an isolation unit, they felt, I can't continue. Like, I was, after getting myself ready to go in there, and they took their lives, you know. And some of those, I've watched how the services have tried so hard to adapt and to be able to provide services to a community that actually lack massively in digital literacy and digital access. So the whole world was being praised about how great it is that people have gone online, or it shows that people can work from home and businesses need to be more flexible to people working from home. But yeah, there's a whole, there's thousands of people who even Googling Zoom and beginning that process is frightening, so frightening that they're afraid to even try. And so I was really, really proud to watch community workers and the service users try their best to support each other to how to understand and how to gain access to the technology. And Community Foundation Ireland gave us a grant to buy people smartphones and laptops and iPads, and we need so much more. We could only cater to a certain amount of people, but watch people trying their best to continue in their recovery even when this was probably the biggest moment that could have shaked everything for them, where they could have lost that ability to stay drug free or alcohol free. And I had a few friends that really struggled with the absence of their fellowship meetings and stuff, you know. Like, there was one or two occasions I had to meet people in parks to walk around with them because they were at that point where they're going, I don't think I can do this, you know, because that support network went from being so obvious and so prevalent to absolutely nothing. And so I think that's who stands out to me, the services that aren't set up to provide care in that way, because they're human services. You know, they're not technology, they're human services that require human interaction and human support. And to watch them to try their best to continue to help people along on their journey, and watching people support their friends on how to get online, or, you know, even within some households, there might be one device where there's three kids trying to do homework and one parent trying to do her addiction counselling, and watch them families trying to move that one device around the household, or even being able to afford to pay for like Wi-Fi and all of that. So watching people support each other in that way to try and continue to access services is probably the group that stands out to me, but it's probably the group I'm closest to see what they're actually doing, you know.
Yeah, Tony, you were about to jump in there before Lynn. Is there any group that surprised you, or maybe not surprised you, but just impressed you, or kind of confirmed what you always thought?
I think the staff in the local SuperValue really have amazed me. They've been incredibly kind and incredibly important. And of course, before this, I certainly took them entirely for granted. But, you know, I really see them now when they're stacking shelves, and I talk to them and I got to know them much better. And there's a real sense that we have genuine conversations. And the same in the pharmacy, and it's the same with the postman. It's the same with the people who've really impressed me have been the people who have been there all the time supporting us. And we didn't see it. We didn't realize it. And because their jobs were the menial jobs, you know, it's horrible even to use that word. But, you know, we regarded them as, you know, as perhaps not having made it because they ended up in a supermarket.
Or maybe never regarded them at all, I guess. And then
we never regarded them at all. Yeah.
And then they really did become the heroes of this period.
I think so. They've really, you know, and I mean, I am in touch with a lot of people who are having difficult times, and I've been working with them and with some groups, and I've no doubt what Lynn is saying is so true. The people I've worked with need hands-on, face-to-face contact. They don't do well with Zoom. You know, I was just on to a guy who I used to work in James's for a long time, but I still keep in touch with some of the madder people, if you like, the people I really got to love because they had the most severe and enduring mental illnesses. But, you know, there's two of them now, and I was on to them, and, you know, they get a visit once a month for a few minutes from a community nurse, which is great. But otherwise, they have no access to James's. The whole outpatient, the whole day hospital, everything is closed down. So they're not getting contact. Now, these are pretty resilient because they've been struggling for so many years. They've developed a kind of resilience. But there are many others who I think the people I'm most concerned about, I don't know who they are. They're the people who are hidden and whose suffering is silent and in our society, and they are behind closed doors and they're not seeing people, and we don't have any idea how difficult their lives may be. And I know in Jigsaw, my own organization, I'm retired now, but they closed down everything in March according to public health policy, and went online, and something happened. It didn't work that well. The staff began to lose morale, and thankfully at the end of summer they realized this is simply not working, and they woke up as an organization and began to see people face to face, to open all their centers and to meet with people and to make all kinds of arrangements that would make that possible, even giving young people, you know, if they needed a pass to come in to see them and all that kind of stuff. So the staff, the morale had taken a huge boost. They're all feeling much better about themselves, because that's what they want to do. That's what they joined Jigsaw to do. And the people, young people, need that sense of contact, that face-to-face, even though some may do okay online, but certainly the more vulnerable people in our society, I think, really need human contact.
So we've talked about the people who have had to adapt and adapted in incredible ways this year. Would some people have found it easier to adapt, and why? Like, what are the characteristics of someone who can adapt better to uncertainty and tough times than others? You might agree, you might have kind of different people in mind, but would there be any common characteristics of people who...
I think with all respect, what is it Jerry Adams says with every respect? I think that's a very dangerous question to ask. And I think it's one of these. It's behind that question, there's a sort of an implication that it's somebody's responsibility if they haven't coped, you know. And I think the people who've coped are the people who had resources. Mm. People like me who don't have financial worries. I'm in a comfortable place, I have a roof over my head, I'm not worried about paying the next bill. I don't owe anybody money, whereas other people find themselves in debt. So I think it's the circumstances that people are in that really dictate how well or not well. And our job, if we care about people, is to resource people who need to be supported, so that they themselves then can find within themselves the capacity to cope. But it's not fair to say to them, if only you had a bit more grit or a bit more discipline or a bit more this, you might be doing better, when actually it's the fact that their livelihood has been taken from them and they're living in a very stressful family, close family environment, you know. So I say that with great respect, but I do think that is that has been floated out there a number of times, you know.
We're all in this together. That's been the consistent message, hasn't it?
I think, you know, that I think just that, you know, I'm doing fine because I'm a better person than you, you know. I'm a stronger person. That's not the case. I would be doing as poorly as anyone were it not for the circumstances and the resources that I very luckily have in my life at this time.
Lynn, would you agree with Tony?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think that question applies to so many things I battle against in general, in politics, in why are people poor? Is it because you're not good enough, not intelligent enough, don't work hard enough, don't get up early enough? You know, it's kind of along that same kind of narrative. So I do agree. And I think Joe Caslin did an amazing art piece in Rua Red recently that just captures it perfectly for me, where, you know, the statement underneath the art installation was that we're all in the same storm, but not the same boat. You know, so, and it ties into what Tony is saying, in that it's circumstances that will dictate. And it goes back to my very first point, that I was able to acknowledge that I could sit in this because I was safe. My very basic need of safety has been met. And had I been in this situation of this pandemic 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I probably would, I don't know how I would have managed. My mental health would have been in the bin at the end of it. Like, it wouldn't have been the same type of experience that I've had, you know.
So Lynn, actually, when we're on the subject of you know, not liking how something sounds, I completely agree, and thanks very much for the feedback. So one of our guests on our last podcast episode was Dr. Sharon Lambert, along with the fantastic Nikki Hayes. And Sharon mentioned that you're not particularly keen on being called resilient. Yeah. But Sharon didn't know you were going to be a guest on this episode. She just brought it up. Is that true?
Yes.
And why?
I absolutely hate the word resilience. I feel like it's some sort of middle class privileged idea that's put on people to be resilient and then be clapped on the back for being so resilient. And when you're resilient, it's like you bounce back to some sort of original state from the experience that you've just had, right? Maybe an operation, you've been resilient, your body has bounced back. It's bouncing back to some sort of preferred state of being and existence, where for me, it's put on people that are in addiction, poverty, inequality, who are almost expected to be resilient, continue to be resilient, but they're not bouncing back to some sort of preferred healthy state. Every time they're being congratulated for being resilient, it's in connection with stuff that they never should be experiencing. So I think people use the word resilient in the completely wrong way, and they use it to overshadow injustices and inequalities. We should never be told we're resilient for having to endure injustice after injustice after injustice. That is not how the word resilience should be used in any shape or form, because they're external things that shouldn't be happening to us. And every time they happen to us, we don't bounce back. Actually, we go further and further into the fringes of society, into the depths of our well-being, and our health outcomes are shot. We die younger, we end up with comorbidity, but yet we're congratulated for our resilience. And I just kind of think it's applied in the wrong way to the wrong groups. And it's like meditation. Like, it's like trying to tell people who are in the depths of chaotic addiction to meditate. And it's kind of like, you can't meditate your way out of €100 a day crack habit. Something else has to happen before you start telling people to meditate or that they're resilient. Do you know what I mean? So it's trying to take all these things that are positive, like meditation, mindfulness, and you can't meditate your way out of poverty. So if your basic needs aren't met, if you're struggling, if you're living in an environment that no matter how hard you try, you will never make it out alive, well, then meditation is definitely not the first port of call. There's a few things that need to happen. So resilience and meditation, sometimes, even though I meditate, I think, like, meditation is so important, and I've done it since I was a kid, since the late Anne Louise Gilligan taught me how to visualize and meditate when I was 15. So it's not that I dismiss meditation as a practice. I dismiss sometimes how it feels like there's some sort of imposing of meditation and resilience on communities that are experiencing hardship instead of governments and societies taking responsibility so that those communities don't experience that level of hardship. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
It does. It does. So the resilience might be one of those words, like many others, that have become a bit of a buzzword.
Yes.
To distract from you know, other things.
Well, if I can just come in there, I agree with everything Lynn is saying, but just to warn her not to listen to Brendan O'Connor's show tomorrow, because I'm on it talking about resilience.
Well, it's great to get two points of view.
No. I think for me, I have the same. I struggle with the same thing. What I'm trying to say tomorrow is it's not the rugged individual that we're all kind of. We've all sort of fallen for this myth of the rugged individual, the person who's struggles ahead, and what is much more real and human is the resourced person, and all the actual science of resilience shows that. Circumstances and supports are a far stronger predictor of how people cope than anything in themselves. Mm-hmm. So resilience is not, resilience is something that we draw on in ourselves to some extent, but it is what we draw on in our relationships and from society. Mm-hmm. And if society hasn't put in place certain kind of basic supports, we don't cope. We are we can become very broken by situations. So it's a funny one because in some ways you want to speak to people in an encouraging way who are maybe facing some difficulty in their life. And you want to, give them a sense that there's something they can do. And at the other hand, I'm trying to do that in a way that doesn't in any way, however subtle, imply that their failure to do it is because of something missing in them. The most people do not need to change. What they do need is to change their world. Mm-hmm. They need to experience and spray painting positive thinking over some horrible toxic situation does not make it go away or make it have any less impact on us. And yet we're told resilience is first cousin is positive thinking. You see, we're told to do these things, and mindfulness, all of these things are not necessarily helpful or appropriate. The studies on all these evidence-based studies in meditation and all these things, they're all done with people who love the practice, who volunteer, who are middle class, who have, but they've never really taken into account the circumstances of those people's lives. And try to see, did that have an effect on whether the meditation helped them? I would say if you took some of the kind of homeless, addicted people that Lynn is referring to, that meditation might have... give me a better example. I worked in James's for 30 years, and I can tell you that, whatever good I did, I'm not sure, I hope it did some good, but I never did as much good as seeing people maybe get moved from a two-bedroom apartment or flat in Fatima to a three bedroom because they had three kids and they needed the space, or they got a job, or they fall in love. It was those events in people's lives that I saw made a difference. And in a sense, I felt, the whole service made a tiny, tiny difference to their lives. I think we spend a fortune on these ideas, but I'm not sure that if you closed it down completely, that would be that missed, and I was there for 30 years and I loved the work I did. But I think that, again, if I was out in the field, and sometimes I did go out in the field and work in a much more in a socially active way with people and empower them to take action on their own behalf, I think that's where change comes. And certainly reading self-help books or listening to TED Talks about resilience won't cut it.
Okay. And I always wonder, Tony, I don't know what you think, but I always remember, I'm writing a piece at the minute about a young man that, when you know, the way obviously we see people sitting in town for hours and hours in the one spot on a bridge, right?
Yeah.
And I'm writing a piece at the minute about young men like that, that don't make their way to the city centre, but they sit outside their local shops. And I suppose the extra layer of complexity and shame that comes with showing just how down you are to the people that you've grown up with and went to school, and they're going in and out of shop and just, but what, when I was writing that piece, I began to really think about what it must take for somebody to sit in that position all day long, you know, and what are the ingredients of meditation anyway? Is it stillness? Is it patience? Is it being able to sit with yourself for hours and hours and hours on end? And I think of the amount of people that do that in isolation every day, who are alone sitting on bridges. And, you know, I was like, are they actually in a meditative state so that they can actually disassociate some at some level and go to some other place in themselves for them to be able to even sit there in the cold, in that stillness? And I always wondered what it is that allows them to be able to do that at some level. I know desperation is there, and obviously, you know, if their situation was better, you'd prefer it. But I just wonder in the level of patience and stillness that that requires.
I think it is dissociation. I think it is people, we know this. It's one of the most basic ways people survive horrific situation is that they dissociate. They take themselves out of that situation into some kind of fantasy world or some dreamlike state. And I think that it could look like they're still and they're not even suffering much, because at that moment they may not be in touch with their suffering. But I'm damn sure if you brought them inside a warm place and gave them a meal and talked to them, that you'd just uncover a great deal of suffering. Now, having said that, I also think that the people I saw in James's so-called patients were very often a lot more resilient than I was myself, if I can use that term incorrectly. But they had qualities of, they had experienced and survived horrific suffering. I mean, just the most unspeakable things that happened to them that should never happen to a human being. And I think, I imagine myself that if I had those same things happen, I would have simply crumbled into a mess on the floor. So I think
that points out, Tony, that resilience basically in those terms used in that way is just people getting used to experiencing trauma and shite, and they don't fall apart because they are so used to experiencing trauma, where somebody that doesn't experience that on a daily basis will be more impacted by it because they haven't acclimatized to that type of living and that type of pain.
Well, that was my next question about, you know, is there a point where resilience, or being called resilience or being expected to be resilient, can be harmful? Can it stop people asking for help or getting the help that they need?
I don't think so. I think I talk about it at a level of groups in society that can do better by groups using it as a way for them to congratulate communities for, you know, withstanding the things that they experience. So for me, I get more annoyed, not about us using it about ourselves or each other at that level, but other groups that are in a much more privileged position congratulating resilience. I think that's what bothers me, because I think that allows them not to act and them not to change. Because if somebody wants to keep calling, say, someone that, like one of my friends who is homeless or who has been on heroin for 20 years, if they want to congratulate them for being resilient as if it's a badge of honor, and then you ask that person, well, do you want to swap experiences? Is resilience that good that it's something that you desire? You know, yeah, so
they're sort of,
you know, you're not going to swap those lives. Like, do you know what I mean? And so for me, I don't think it'll stop someone seeking help or asking for help. I think it will stop people that don't experience what we experience acting.
Okay. Tony, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of us have something inside us. To me, the Brendan Kennelly captured it very well when he talked about, in a world that dreams of ending, that always seems about to give in, something inside us insists that we forever begin. I'm misquoting, I'm sorry, but
it's still beautiful.
It's his poem, but I think there is that something. But what results have shown? I mean, there's some fantastic studies that I've come across, and they're the kind of studies you'd love, Lynn, but what they've shown over and over again is that it's beginning to match or that inner strength that we all have to the right kind of supports and environments that can kind of draw them out, you know. But I mean, it's the mixture of all of those things working together, and they need to fit the person. So the addict in that situation may need a homeless service, where somebody else may need MABS or something. There's different. So it's about the fit between where I am in my life and the supports that I need from others, and that, it's that combination. I was always clear in James's that I never cured anyone. I never actually made them better. But what I did was to allow them to heal within themselves by understanding what was happening and understanding what they needed and what would help, and then helping them navigate the world they were in to get that help, whatever. And sometimes that help was, credit union, not a therapist. And sometimes it was me, but I was the one who was, if you like, brokering their relationships between them and their world.
Tony, I think it's like what when you explain teachers being the carriers of change. I suppose therapists and community workers and mental health workers are in that bracket as well, of being carriers and facilitators.
Absolutely.
And signposts. Absolutely. You know.
Yeah. Turnaround teachers. They use that phrase in the States. The teachers that have the capacity to help somebody turn around their lives. You know, they're just amazing.
So, talking of asking for help and being able to ask for help and having that space to do so, is it fair to say that this generation or young people are better at talking about their mental health and asking for help for their mental health? Is that a fair statement to say that? Are we in a better place?
I don't know if I can answer that. I think I talk very much from my class, from my social setting, from my community, and our traumas and our mental health issues are as prevalent as they ever were. So are we better at asking for help, or are we better at giving help, is probably the better question, because, you know, drug use continues to rise, mental health continues to be a massive issue. So I don't know if I can answer that. It's probably, there is obviously a lot more dialogue about mental health, but I think maybe we've just learned in what way to put a narrative on it. But people have been talking about their mental health for years, whether it's a woman in her 50s saying, I'm having a nervous breakdown, or me nerves, you know, that's changed to I suffer with anxiety. So I think at some level, we've always named it. We've just named it differently. You know, like, obviously there's a lot more, we have a lot more access to conversations because of like social media and campaigns, and that's obviously a lot more prevalent. But I don't know whether getting to the crux of actually addressing mental health is getting better, because society at a resource level needs to move with the mental health supports, and that's not happening. So it's a tug of war between the resource question and the circumstance question and the mental health question. So you can provide mental health care all you want, but if you're not changing people's circumstances, and if you're not investing in communities on a whole. So it's like, I always go back to this idea that one person can transcend their class, but it's when class can transcend class that we've actually achieved something. So I think we're getting better at helping individuals, but when will we get better at bringing the whole of society up to a level so that we experience less mental health issues, you know? So we all have to transcend that level of care and asking for help. And that's very much down to actually addressing the other stuff like inequality and other different, scenarios that create kind of poor mental health.
So Tony, from your point of view as a clinical psychologist and someone who's worked in the mental health services for decades, Would you agree? Have we come, you know, kind of a bit of a way? Have things changed since, you know, when you first started working in the services? Or would you agree with Lynn?
I think that there's certainly been a dramatic change since 2006. I put it back to that time when it, mental health in any form was still a very shameful and hidden reality in our community. People had to hide it. My mother always said not a word as she was taken off to St. Patrick's on several occasions. And I couldn't tell anyone, you know, couldn't even tell her husband, who was in the Cyprus or the Lebanon with the UN forces at the time. But, you know, it was a very shameful thing. So we brought it out of the cupboard a little bit. And we can now say, I don't feel okay. The language we've given people troubles me immensely. The people have labels about themselves that are not necessarily appropriate. They may be helpful in the moment, but they're if they could only think of them as a skin or as that they will shed at some point. You know, I think they may serve a time, but they're not stuck with super glue to their souls. You know, and I think so that troubles me in some ways about mental health. We're giving people a language for things, and we're also a lot of it is self-labeling. You know, I don't know. The services are much better. I this is the part of me that really does feel sad. I've been wrestling with some mental hospitals recently, one in particular, and it's been appalling what's going on with the young woman. And I just can't believe it's as inadequate as it is. And honestly, you know, 30 years ago, I'm not sure that it wouldn't have been better. So, there's something, we're still tending to see the individual as the source of all their problems in their lives. There's something wrong with you. And we take them out of their environment. We take them out of their families, out of relationships. And we say, I'm going to fix you now because you have a chemical imbalance. And so there's still that. We're not in any way thinking of people in terms of their social circumstances or even their family lives. So in the case I'm dealing with at the moment, this young woman, her parents are very kind of caring and very important in her life. And none of the team in a month of treatment have asked to see the parents, despite the parents writing and saying, I'd like to talk, because we're all in this together and she's coming home at the weekend and we don't know what, you know. So, you know, to me, that would be unthinkable to think of somebody as being so. And by the way, this young person was very happy to have her parents involved. It wasn't, you know. So there's something about our services that to me is still stuck in a very unhelpful frame, a paradigm of healthcare. I do wonder at times if you burnt them all down, would it make that much difference? I generally think that services and psychology particularly needs to get out from their offices and move into community spaces where people are living and have much closer contact with them in those, in schools, in youth centres, in community centres. That's where life is unfolding for people who are troubled, and that's where psychology may have something to give as part of a multidisciplinary team. But that multidisciplinary team includes, you know, somebody from, it's not FOSS anymore, what's it called?
Solace.
It's just different, you know. We need NABS, Solace, Vince. It's those kind of, we need real active services. Come back to where we started from with these community services. But, you know, I just don't rate a great deal what happens in hospitals. You know, services don't make people better in any way. And that's the first thing. Services do not help people. People help people. And, you know, you're lucky enough sometimes to meet somebody in a service or in a school or a teacher who kind of connects. I just feel there's a great lack of real connection happening with people, even at an individual basis. I mean, never mind trying to understand and engage them in terms of their social context. It is kind of a medical model that's still there. We've dressed it up with different language. I think we're stuck in some place, and it is kind of what Lynn is saying. We need a revolution. We need to wake up to the fact that, and maybe COVID has really shown us that a sense of contact with the people near us and around us, our families, our communities, is the basic living resources that we all need. You know, I'm not talking about anything special. If you take the people in where you're living, Lynn, and you did a study between giving them proper educational opportunities, proper allowance, living allowance, mm-hmm. Maybe for the mothers, you know, a babysitter, and you did something like that and nothing else, and then mm-hmm. you compare that with a mental health intervention, yeah. I'm damn sure which one would be the success totally. In making their lives feel better, you know. And that's the study that's never done. It's much easier to think that the problems we have are because of individuals who are very, God loves them, sure, that they can't help themselves. It's, you know, to blame the victim. It's much easier to do that than to look at what surrounds that person's life and realize there's just such inequity there. There's such injustice. Mm. We need to change this. And I mean, and that's where politicians are really the frontline mental health services. And because they can make change at that level, perhaps, well, I'm not saying it's just them, but they can do a great deal. Mm. I'm going to say tomorrow, for me, frontline mental health services are the mothers, families, teachers, and civil servants who make policy to resource families. These are the people who are, and then when they fail for whatever reason, you know, way down the line, a person ends up falling into the arms of St. Patrick's Hospital or somewhere else. And that's, you know, I was just thinking, I mean, that's like, so the answer is not just to put more and more beds in yes. acute psychiatric services, but it's to really look at, hold on, what's happening upstream that we're getting all these bodies floating down half dead, you know?
Yeah, like, I mean, there's no multidisciplinary approach from politics. They think they can shoehorn mental health as if it's this one entity that they can point at and go, that's mental health. And obviously you have so many levels of that, right from, you know, intermittent anxiety to serious, serious psychiatric issues. And they want to go, we're going to give so much money to mental health, right? And it's so unintelligent. Like, it's kind of gone, hang on, right? So at what point do departments realize that every single department within Leinster House is responsible for mental health? If you're the housing department, you are responsible for mental health. If you're the health, you're responsible for mental health. Even right down to like the climate department will become responsible for it. So everybody should have within their portfolios the things that housing, like the fact that like nobody looks at the fact that how estates are built, how on top of each other they are, putting people in one bedroom flats when they have three children. They're creating mental health issues, and then they're telling another department to go, right, now you're responsible for funding mental health services. Like, it's the same concept and logic of funding prisons. It's the same thing. It's like, at what point do you realize that all your planning, like when you are planning communities and estates, and why is nobody working together to mental health proof it, poverty proof it, gender proof it? And if they done all those things in all of their departments, well, then ultimately we would have less mental health issues in the long run, I believe, anyway.
So as we move into kind of a new space of living with COVID in 2021, do you think that we will see improvements in a connection to every aspect of someone's life when it comes to the support that they get and have access to?
No. Okay. No, I think people will be eager to get back to whatever it was we were like before. I don't think the opportunities have been taken. We had opportunities in the last 9 months to put people into houses, to act quickly. Like in the beginning, we were able to put homeless people into apartments, right? That may be COVID positive, to only put them back out again. Like, where does that? So that apartment is free. You just pulled that apartment out of nowhere. And now where are all them apartments going? So there was a real opportunity to think better about all of this. You know, like if we look at the National Drug Strategy, which I'd be most involved in, the fact that the minister did great in putting, he was the only one at the time that was responding to very particular needs of addiction communities. And he came back and brought out his own regulations that were aside to the general regulations about addiction services meeting. Right. But what they did was then they announced funding. And it was only 20,000 per task force. And they announced this as 480,000. 20,000 per task force, which would be spread out across, in some cases, 10 different, 20,000 across 10 different services for them to be able to adapt and reopen their services. So you wouldn't even buy one thing of Perspex for people to meet with €20,000. So they didn't really take the opportunity to revamp any of those spaces to do real work. And what they also done was they put... They made Keltai obviously an isolation unit, and now there's threats that Keltai is not going to cut. Keltai was the only centre of its kind in the whole country, and now that's at threat of being returned. So if anything, some services are worse off, are not being invested in, and I mean that's only going to have a knock-on effect. Like, so I don't, you know, I don't believe we're going to be in, some individuals might be in, but I think we will very quickly return to how we are. If ever the word resilient was going to be used, I'd use it now, and I'd say that society will bounce back into the exact shape it was in before COVID.
Okay, Tony, would you agree there? Do you think that we're just going to go back, everything that we've learned and reflected on, we're just going to go back to how things were next year?
Well, the optimist in me or the hopeful person in me would really want to believe that we've been shown one thing from this COVID, which is that political decisions we never thought possible. We laughed at Bernie Sanders or what's his name, and the other Labour guy in England, and we thought they were ridiculous, in terms of putting people on a sustainable livable income and all those things. We thought that was ridiculous, and now we've discovered actually it's possible, and all kinds of other things we've been shown are possible. A lot of what needs to happen in mental health, I mean, I read the recent program Sharing the Vision, and it has some glaring gaps in it, but overall it's the most socially conscious and the most community-based model of mental health care I've ever seen. And if we could put that into, if we could implement that, we would see major differences. Major differences. So if we can just, I don't know, history has shown over and over again that people go back to the status quo. I think resilience is not about bouncing back. It's about bouncing forward. Mm. It's about being changed by an experience so that you see yourself in a different way and you see the world in a different way and you act in a different way. And that is what's remarkable. Lynn described it beautifully in terms of her own journey. That's, to me, resilience in action. Mm. And it's not just inside Lynn. It's in her... relationship and her connections to everything that cares about her in this society, and she's been able to use those things and work on herself and that. So I want us to bounce forward. Mm. I want us not just to go back. I don't know what government would be able to do that at the moment. I don't see a great deal of, there's not a lot I see in government that gives me hope, that we would change, because it is a kind of very fundamental change. And I'm not sure that the appetite is there. So I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I hope there's changes for, it'll probably happen. Change doesn't happen top down. It happens at the edges of society. Yeah. It may be in small groups that really begin to start thinking differently about themselves. Mm-hmm. It's Black Lives Matter. You know,
I do agree.
Our lives matter. Yeah.
I do agree that the changes will happen personally for people. I suppose I'm more thinking at that societal higher up level in terms of change. I mean, we only saw a vote this week not to pay student nurses, like, yet we were calling them heroes a few weeks ago, and then we're still going to say but you shall work for free. You know, so it's real, like, you know, if you're going to value something, place value on it. And I'm just afraid that, like, at that higher policy level, that the value won't be placed on the things that it needs to be placed on.
Lynn and Tony, thank you so much for joining us today. Just a final question is something that we ask all of our guests. Lynn, who or what has got you through recent tough times?
Just being at home, being with my family. To be honest, I feel I haven't had to imply anything to get me through. I think I'd be only making stuff up if I was to come up with things that helped me get through. I think, like I said at the beginning, whatever work I've been doing up until this point is what has helped me get through. And that's all I could wish for anyone, is to be safe enough in their lives that they can weather such a storm. And unfortunately, that's not the case. But it has been for me this time, which obviously is great. But it comes with an immense amount of guilt as well, when you know that you know, other people are not experiencing life in the same way that you are.
Tony, what about yourself? Not just this year, but, you know, in general, who or what would get you through tough times?
That's a big question.
It is.
I think what's got me through this year more than anything else it's been the kindness of strangers, just ordinary people who ask me how I am and care about me and support me in very practical ways in the supermarket and the community. What is it that really gives me a lift and makes my life matter? It's when I know that I matter to other people. I matter to the animals I'm looking after. I matter to the garden I'm taking care of. And on a good day, a really good day, I make some difference in somebody's life. I say the right word, or I just whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And I do think that is something we all deeply need. And the best Christmas present I can think of giving anyone is to let them know that they matter, and that they matter in my life in some way. And that, I think that's what it comes down to. When I feel I matter, I feel I belong. And when I open my heart to other people more, and then they do the same to me, and we connect. And I think that is what keeps me going at any time.
Okay, thank you. And just for our listeners, visit mentalhealthireland.ie for resources and information on how to mind your mental health.